Good morning, everybody. It's Tessa here. I'm with Graham, and we have Annie Ford with us today to talk about the benefits of a good sleep pattern. So to introduce Annie to you all, I'd just like to say that Annie is a BACP accredited counsellor who is very passionate about health and well-being. She's got over 40 years experience in NHS secondary and primary care and has worked as a midwife, a Macmillan nurse specialising in gynaecological oncology. She's a lead nurse for NHS projects in health diversity and is deputy director of nursing in secondary care. As a specialist counsellor, Annie works for the NHS London staff support. She is a Living Well with Cancer retreat facilitator at Pennybron, a leading cancer support centre, and for Devon Insight as a counsellor, and she's been with us for some 3 years. As a counsellor, Annie is also a group facilitator at Breast Cancer Now with secondary breast cancer support groups. She's completed advanced training in oncology, as well as diplomas in life and business coaching, NLP, complementary therapies and integrative counselling. Annie has also completed specialist RNIB training to support her work for clients with sight impairment. Annie is also a wife, a mum, and a keen advocate for mindfulness. So Annie, we know that losing your sight is very traumatic and that sleep is an essential function that is interconnected with several other mental and physical health conditions. We know that getting a good night's sleep can make a remarkable difference to your mood and overall well-being. So if you're struggling to get a good night's sleep, what can we do about it, Annie?
That's a million-dollar question. Thank you so much, everybody, for inviting me. It's lovely to be here. And I have prepared a little presentation which I thought I would just work through. And I'm very mindful that clients who have got sight impediment, that it can sometimes affect with the whole spectrum of sight loss, that it can affect the melatonin and serotonin balance in the body. And I just thought it would be helpful for me perhaps just to explain a little bit about sleep and living well. But sleep is often one of the first things to go when people feel pressed for time or they're very stressed. And many view sleep as a luxury and think that the benefits of limiting the hours they spend in sleep outweigh the cost. But we often overlook the potential long-term health consequences of insufficient sleep and the impact that health problems can ultimately have on one's time and productivity. Now, we know that sleep, all the evidence shows that sleep is probably one of the biggest determinants of mental health and well-being. So protecting our sleep is really important. And circadian rhythms, I'm sure everybody's heard of the term circadian rhythms, and sometimes you hear these terms but we don't really understand them. So a circadian rhythm is when we go to sleep, about every hour and a half or every hour to hour and a half, our body goes into a coma for about 6 minutes, and that's known as REM or deep sleep, so every 6 minutes. So the body tends to operate in sort of 60 to 90 minute rhythms. So when we go to sleep, those circadian rhythms are really secured and stabilized, and we really need those rhythms to be in place. So with humans, circadian rhythms are the approximate 24-hour patterns the body and the brain go through, allowing for changes in the body's physical and our mental health, along with mood and behavioral changes. So that's why as humans we become tired at night and feel more awake during the day. So this 24-hour pattern is what most people refer to when they talk about our circadian rhythms. So when the human body goes through stages of sleep when we lay down to rest, and any interference with the sleep cycle can cause tiredness and irritability the following day. And I think all of us can relate to that. So some of us who are a bit stressed, you know, I know going through the menopause, 70% of women will be affected, will have some form of sleep disturbance on the menopausal journey. So there's two types of sleep known to us. One is called non-REM sleep, and that's where we're not in a coma. And REM sleep is when we are in this approximate coma, where the body just relaxes. And during that REM dip, what actually happens is that the body produces lots of lovely melatonin when we go to sleep and have these rapid eye movements, 6-minute slots throughout the night, every hour and a half. And with melatonin, we need melatonin to calm the brain down overnight. We need it to boost our immunity. We need it to nurture all the vital organs in our bodies. And it also boosts our immune system. So sleep is actually really, really, really important. With our sleep, the heart rate and blood pressure increase. Arms and legs, when we're in this deep sleep, experience a type of paralysis that keeps us from acting out our dreams. Some people will walk or sleepwalk during REM sleep, which is often common. We see that in children sometimes, but also sometimes in adults. And that can be during the REM sleep bit. But the process of actually dreaming, which is also part of that REM dip, is not fully understood. But we know the process stimulates the part of the brain used for learning and our memory. So we do dream when we go to sleep. And actually dreaming is really good. It's really good for us. It helps us to clear the brain down from what's happened the day before as we process stuff that has probably happened to us the night before. So with our sleep patterns, going back to the circadian rhythms, when we're asleep, we produce melatonin. And then when the daylight comes up normally, then our bodies start to produce serotonin. So we produce melatonin when we're asleep, and during the day we produce serotonin. And serotonin is also very good for us. So we need a balance of both hormones. But with sight impediments, that can affect the balance because of the damage to various parts of the eye and the nerve pathways. So people with sight impediments need to have really strict hygiene, sleep hygiene, which I'm going to talk to you a little bit about in a minute. But actually just by living a balanced life in the day and sleeping well at night, then everything becomes balanced. So during the day, 90% of our serotonin is produced in the gut. So that's everybody used to think it was produced in the brain, but actually it's not. 10% is produced in the brain, but actually 90% is known to be produced in the gut. And serotonin is a chemical. Its main goal is to send signals between our nerve cells, and it's considered a natural mood stabilizer. It plays a critical role in regulating our sleep, our digestion, and maintaining good bone health. So serotonin is actually, can sometimes be called the happy hormone, and that's necessary for our brain health. So if we sleep well in the night, then we should have a good balance of melatonin and then serotonin in the day. How much sleep do we need? That's a million-dollar question. For good health, we need at least 6 hours of non-REM sleep, which is the where we're kind of semi-awake, but we're actually asleep. And we need a good hour of REM sleep every night. They're the 6-minute slots that we have when we're actually physically asleep. So with sleep, it's necessary for just keeping us well. And just to let you all know that women need a little more sleep than men. And sometimes we need a little bit more sleep in the winter than we do in the summertime. And we don't know why that happens, if it's a primal evolution of man. But 17 hours of continuous sleeplessness leads to a decrease in performance. So when we're not sleeping well, we're a bit out of kilter. So just looking at the history of sleep. So estimated in the 20th century, we had 8 to 9 hours of sleep in the early 20th century. And in the 1980s to 2020, the researchers found out that on average, people were having about 7 to 8 hours of sleep. In the 1980s, they did some research into college students, and they reported that they were only having 6 hours sleep. So it's getting less, and that could be related to, you know, just the new ways of working that we work. And going to bed later is now, in 2023, is 1 to 2 hours later than it was 25 years ago. So it's really important that we really protect our sleep and access support if we're not sleeping properly. And sleep deprivation can lead to chronic tiredness, mood changes, difficulty controlling our emotions, or an inability to think, you know, creatively. So in order to be at our peak performance, we need at least 8 hours. Some people will need a bit less, some people will need a little bit more. Not everyone needs the same amount, but sleeping less than six hours or more than 9 is associated with a greater risk of other diseases. So we're always very mindful of that. So there's an increased risk, if we don't sleep, of heart disease and other immune conditions. So just getting the help that we need is very good. So when we do sleep, it keeps our heart healthy. Shift workers have to be very mindful of self-care, particularly if they're out of balance with their sleep. Dr. Michael Mosley has done a lot of research on that. And melatonin protects our immune system, and good sleep reduces inflammation in our bodies. And when we sleep well, we have better energy for the day. And in all the studies that they've done, people who have slept well performed better in a range of tests when they took people to the lab to look at their sleep. So it also helps, sleep helps with reduced risks of weight gain, risks of depression. So what I've done is, and the team will send it out to you today, I've prepared a little sheet on sleep hygiene. So probably as a postmenopausal woman, I think I'm still a bit menopausal actually, but I'm really curious about sleep and things that we can do to help ourselves to sleep well. So it's really important that we try and stick to a sleep schedule that works for you and try to stick to it. Paying attention to sleep hygiene is one of the most straightforward ways that you can set yourself up for better sleep. And strong sleep hygiene means having both a calm bedroom environment and daily routines that promote consistent uninterrupted sleep. And keeping a stable sleep schedule, making your bedroom comfortable and free of disruptions, following a relaxing pre-bed routine and building healthy habits during the day can all contribute to good sleep hygiene. But it's really important for our physical and our mental health. And if you have any issues, like even any pain or any worries that your circadian rhythms are being disrupted, it's really important to speak to your medical team or your eye specialist team about little things that you can do. And everybody talks about sleep hygiene. So what the research shows is that it's very important to avoid caffeine. And as we age, caffeine is not only a bladder irritant, but it's also a sleep that can affect how we quality of sleep. And I've worked with many clients who've even just cut back on coffee. Now, on the paper that I used to prepare my presentation for today, it does say 4 p.m., but in women's health, when you work with experts in the field of physiotherapy for women's pelvic floors and men's bladders, actually cutting back on caffeine from about 1 o'clock in the day is usually advocated because it does irritate our bladders. And it's really important that you're mindful of that. Also, alcohol, they advocate not to drink alcohol for about 4 hours before going to bed because that can actually interrupt our REM sleep. And there's different research out now to show it used to be thought that don't take a long daytime nap. But they recommend now that if you are having little naps in the middle of the day, little power naps, I call them, you know, not to let it go on too long, maybe to set an alarm to maybe for it to be 10 minutes. And I have a friend who's a psychiatrist, and he does have power naps during the day because he works quite a long day. So he has a power nap in the morning and he has a little power nap in the afternoon. He said it just really helps to rest and replenish him enough for him to go forward with a stressful day. So for some of us, if our sleep is out of kilter, we might be tempted to have an hour's kip in the morning, you know, at lunchtime. We don't advocate that. It's usually in little 10-minute spurts, if you can do that. Not exercising too much close to bedtime. And good things that we can use, sleep-inducing foods containing a hormone called tryptophan, T-R-Y-P-T-O-P-H-A-N, help sleep, converting them into serotonin and melatonin. And those foods are milk, maybe a banana, a little bit of turkey, and leafy green vegetables, believe it or not, which is really interesting. Foods that can keep us awake include heavy spicy foods, chilies and curries, and drinking, I've mentioned tea, coffee, chocolate and Coca-Cola, not recommended. Foods that are high in sugar and fat, so maybe thinking about trying to eat your evening meal probably around 6 to 7 o'clock if you can manage it. Some people do eat very late, you know, some people eat their evening meal at 9, but the nutritionists don't recommend that, and for sleep experts they don't recommend that you eat too late either. Foods that can contain high levels of MSG, monosodium gluconate, like Chinese takeaway meals. Some of the Chinese foods now, you can actually ask for them not to use MSG in your food that you have. And a lot of people don't know that. Smoked meats, apparently. I don't eat smoked meats, but I do like a bit of smoked salmon. And soy products, for some reason, can interfere with foods that interfere with sleep. And that, I know that's a busman's tour for everybody around sleep, but I just thought it was really important for me to share with you about the mind, the body, and the spirit. And sleep is also about the environment that we're sleeping in. So for some of us, making sure that we have the right temperature to sleep in. If we've got very hot duvets on, keeping the body calm, just having that thermoregulation overnight is actually really important. And just, I would say, you know, having your bedroom as your spa, really, with not too many interruptions. And for some people, if they do wake up in the middle of the night, some people will lie there and just wait to go back to sleep. But actually, doing some 4, 7, and 8 breathing is really helpful, because that actually calms the sympathetic nervous system down, which is a system that gets a little bit wound up when we're a little bit stressed or anxious. Dr. Michael Mosley has written around sleep, and he himself is an insomniac, and he gives a tip. So I know for him, he gets up and he listens to the radio, and having, I think, Radio 4 is one of the radio stations that just has the right voice type for us all in the middle of the night, put on very low. Some people will use apps like Calm or other apps available to listen to some calming sounds like woodland or waves coming in or trains. You know, there's lots of little settings that you can have for sleep rhythms to try and get back to sleep again. But you know, after many years of working with clients with a range of health issues or stress issues, or sometimes when we're depressed we don't sleep so well, but actually finding what works for you will be different to what works for everybody else. So being mindful of what you need is really important. And if something works, then go with that. And if it's not working, then I would always advocate that you get things checked out with your GP. So that's me, everybody. I know it's been a bit of a busman's tour, but I know we've got time for questions now. And it can take, because I've got until 12 o'clock, so as you need, really.
Annie, can we come in now and just say, there's a couple of things you talked about in your talk. Firstly, thank you. I found that really useful on a personal level. But you talked about 4-7-8 breathing. Could you just go over what that means?
Yes. 4-7-8 breathing is in therapy and in lots of other breathing schools, such as yoga or mindfulness or lots of different types of meditation that we can do. The 4-7-8 breathing technique has been around for thousands of years. And when we go into the stress response, we produce a hormone called cortisol. And then when we become quite stressed, we produce adrenaline and noradrenaline. Now, what research shows is that by breathing, by using this breathing technique, it's 4-7-8, and it can also be 4-4-4. It's called box breathing, where we take a breath in. So actually, let's have a practice. So if anybody's got any breathing difficulties, please don't try this. But yes, you can actually try it really gently. So the breathing technique that I teach in my practice is where we just breathe in for 4 through the nose. So big breath in, breathing in for 4. And then just holding the breath to the count of 7. Breathing out slowly through the mouth to the count of 8. And relax the body. And we just try that again. So breathing in for 4, filling the lungs, just very gently breathing in through the nose, breathe in, count to 4, hold the breath, count to 7, and breathe out slowly through the mouth to the count of 8. And relax. Just calm, calm, calm.
Right,
I'm lightheaded now. Does it feel calmer in your body, though?
Yes.
Yeah, it works. It takes a little practice. And then with the 4-7-8 breathing, it's also good for panic. So I work with clients if they might be feeling a little bit panicked or overwhelmed, is just to step away from the lion if you're in a stress response. And just to do a little bit of 4-7-8 gentle breathing. You can pop to the loo or pop to your car or pop away from the trigger area. But also in the middle of the night when we can't get back to sleep, sometimes by doing the 4-7-8 breathing technique, it actually really helps to calm the sympathetic nervous system to say, look, there's no danger here. You're safe. You're calm. You can do this.
Annie, can I ask you about racing thoughts? I quite often will wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm thinking about work, recruitment, preparing for a speaker event, preparing for this, something else going on, family issues. You know, we've got issues with dementia in my family at the moment, all that sort of stuff. So the brain, and it's going at 100 miles an hour. Literally, you've just given us this breathing technique. Is there something else we can do as well?
Yes, there is, actually. What you can do before you go to bed, when you have your bed ritual, what's really important is to have a bed ritual. Now, Dr. Neil Stanley, who comes down to from London, he's a professor of sleep at Surrey University, and he's written extensively on sleep. He comes down to our groups for us. And what he recommends is that when we start thinking about going to bed, we prepare for about maybe at least 90 minutes before we actually go to bed. So having those rituals to get yourself ready for bed. Now, in therapy, what we recommend is that when you have all these worries going round and round and round in your head, is to have either a journal, or you can use a voicemail. Yeah, you know, your recorder, your voice recorder. and to put all your worries down before you actually go to bed. So to even just do some bullet points of what you're worried about. And by physically getting them out from the body to your head, onto a recorder or onto a piece of paper, to get them out, can sometimes help you just to put your worries to one side. And then when you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you can say to yourself, it's okay, I've written all my worries down and I've put my worries away and I'm going to do some 4, 7, and 8 breathing now. I'm going to try and get myself back to sleep again. I would also do some of the sleep hygiene advice that I've given you, Graham, and it's in the presentation I sent to you. And to get into good habits, and also if you are stressed, Buddha would say, when we're stressed, we need to meditate for 1 hour every day, but if we're very stressed, we need to meditate for 2. So with worries in the middle of the night, it's very much of an art, and really protecting sleep. And I recommend Neil Stanley's book. It's just called Sleep. It's a very good book.
That's great. Thank you very much. What about, you've talked about the stimulants like caffeine. What about taking things like Nitol or things like that? Do you have any thoughts?
Yes, I do, actually. With Nitol, there is what they say is if you have 2 disturbed nights, then you've got a sleep problem. You know, if you have 2 disturbed nights on the trot. But if you have 2 weeks of disturbed nights, then you've got some sort of a sleep disorder. So for everybody, if they've been had disturbed sleep for more than 2 weeks, I would usually advocate that they go and speak to their GP. Now, there's a range of drugs out on the market. There's Nitol, which has got, I think it's promethazine, which is the drug that's actually in it. It's got the same drug. Some people will access the same drug in antihistamines. So some of the antihistamines can actually cause you make you feel drowsy and get you off to sleep. It's a drug called diphenhydramine, which is in Nitol. But that can be a little bit, what happens is, the goal is to take Nitol maybe once or twice a week, possibly, but not to take it every night. Because if you take it every night, then it can be a little bit addictive. And it doesn't work as well. So if we take it every night, then it's just not going to work long term because your body becomes acclimatized to it. So, I would strongly recommend that you take advice from your GP and practice good sleep hygiene before you start taking any drugs, really.
So can I ask, Annie, would that apply to taking something like paracetamol? You know, so somebody who might take paracetamol before they go to bed, who wouldn't normally take painkillers, would the same apply to them?
Well, I've not heard of paracetamol as a sleep remedy. But if that works for somebody, there's no, if there are no other underlying medical conditions, and it is quite safe to take 2 paracetamol before bed. But I don't know if that would be a placebo effect, possibly. I don't know. It would be something that you could talk to a GP about. But paracetamol is actually quite a safe drug. It's used for a range of pain management conditions. It's really good for a range of conditions. It's quite a mild drug and it doesn't interfere with the stomach, or there's no known side effects to it that would cause you to have like ulcers or anything like that. Ibuprofen, we don't recommend that you take that at night. Yes, if you do have pain, but you always take it with food so that it lines the coating in your stomach. But the drugs that are out on the market, there's a herbal Nitol available, which I think is called Calms or something. There's a drug called Calms. And the other drug, diphenhydramine. That is a temporary first aid plaster, really, for sleep problems. And if you have got sleep problems, I would just go and speak to your GP about it.
I'm just going to next door and ask Jenny to take the mute off so that we can invite calls from other people. I'm just looking at my notes here. We did have I had a call with somebody last week who said that they often wake up with aching legs and feet. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Aching legs and feet. Graham, that's a really interesting question, because with aching legs and feet, there's probably a whole range of reasons. And when you say to me aching legs and feet, I'm thinking of somebody in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s and 90s, and everybody's reasons for having aching feet will be different. And for patients who have chemotherapy, for example, they do get a little bit of peripheral neuropathy. And as we age, naturally, the circulation is probably not as good in our 50s, 60s, and 70s as it was in our 20s. So there's a whole range of reasons for aching pains and feet. It could be related to, for some clients, women particularly going through the menopause, they do get more body aches and pains. And when we're stressed, we get aches and pains in our bodies. And there's a whole range of medical conditions that will give us aches and pains in our bodies. So that's a huge question to ask, because everybody's situation is different with aches and pains in their bodies.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Annie. We're now going to open up the call for questions. Does anybody want to start us off with a question today?
Can I, this is Les, can I just confirm something?
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your presentation. It's absolutely lovely, and it's very well put in the sense that it covered a very large area, which particularly has concerned me over the time. But I think one of the things as well, just taking up your point about perhaps having or dealing with aches and pains in the legs, is that one of the things that I was warned about a few years ago, I was borderline obese, and I did the diet and thing, et cetera, the GP advice, and then I was put on statins, and I was told that for some people who take statins, they may experience mild or severe cramps in the legs, which may manifest itself as an ache in a joint or something like that. And if that occurs, is yet again, stop taking the statins straight away and go to the GP and tell them, because there are different statins, which I've experienced at the moment with Lloyd's Chemist closing down. So that was quite an important thing. And just one very quick thing, but your breathing advice was absolutely spot on, because one of the things I've started to look at is breathing appropriately for different situations. Like if I'm working, get the oxygen inside to activate the body, but then relaxing and using that deep breathing technique, which is absolutely wonderful for people in relation to having that sort of centered feeling and providing the appropriate oxygen at the appropriate time. So thank you very much for that. It was very interesting.
Thank you for pointing out about the aches and pains. But yes, and there are a lot of people on statins at the moment. So with some of the common side effects of statins can be headache, dizziness, nausea. For some people, it'll affect their digestive system. And for some people, they get muscle pain, and some people will describe it as cramps in my legs, and they wake up in the middle of the night with cramps. But we do also know that if you're suffering from fatigue, if you went to your doctor, if you were worried about, you know, feeling fatigue, one of the blood tests that they do for fatigue management, they check for levels of vitamin B12 and magnesium. And low levels of magnesium in our diet, or however we get magnesium into our bodies. Magnesium is also, in the new age of healthy sleep, a lot of people are talking about magnesium supplements, but that means that you have to take medical advice for that. And that low levels of magnesium can cause muscle cramps, which can show up in the middle of the night. I'm also mindful that in the BBC News today, they talked about pharmacists taking on more of a role in healthcare provision. And I managed a project in London, it was some time ago now, about 2014, where we trained up about 14 pharmacists in the local area in southwest London to manage minor ailments. And the pharmacist is actually a really good professional to go to talk about sleep and to talk about any of your ailments, actually, because they know more about all drugs than some of the junior doctors, for sure,
yeah.
And some of the senior doctors too, actually. But with I always think of my, when I work with clients, I always kind of think very holistically. So I look at the mind, the body, the spirit, and I look at diet, quality of sleep, exercise is also really important. So for any aches and pains that are hanging around that you're worried about, I would just ask, go back to your doctor and ask them just to check it out for you.
Thank you.
Hello, Annie. It's Karen here. Hello. Thank you so much. That lovely chat. Like the last time as well, looking forward to you coming again. I've got two questions. The first one is I can take, I have osteoarthritis, so and I'm 70, and a severe mind loss as well. For the osteoarthritis, And also I'm finding it difficult to get to sleep, or I have disjointed sleep. I wake up and need to go to the loo. I go back to sleep. I wake up an hour later and go to the loo, go back to sleep. So I take diazepam and codeine some nights, and other nights I might take two paracetamol, and then other nights I don't take anything. So my question is, the quality of sleep, when you take these drugs, what is the quality? Do you still get your 6 minutes within that sleep?
Yes, you should do, actually. And I'm just wondering, actually, with the diazepam, how long have you been on the diazepam for?
Yeah. Oh, years. But actually, I have that also because I have spasms of the esophagus. So I don't take it. I don't have a... my doctor trusts me, and basically I have one packet of diazepam a month. You know, so I will. I always take it with the codeine together, and that helps me to go to sleep. But at the same time, then I'll also have two paracetamol another night, and that will help me to go to sleep. So, you know, I kind of judge it.
Do you actually stay asleep when you go to bed? Because what's important is actually this, if you can get 6 hours on a run, it's actually really good for our mental health. And
no, I don't. And a lot of my friends who are about the same age as me, they don't. We've talked about this. We don't have a kind of straight sleep. You know, there are times where you just wake up. And okay. Yeah.
Okay, and... you know, it's again with some of the information that I sent to Graham. I would be very happy if it was helpful for you, and I would do it in agreed time with you. But because it's such a wide subject, I would be very happy to maybe have a one-to-one, half an hour conversation with you outside the meeting about your sleep, because there are lots of other things that can be done to help you.
Mm. Oh, thank you. That would be lovely, Annie. Yes. So I Tessa has my phone number.
Great.
If you'd ever want to ring me, and yes, we could set something up.
Lovely. But, and I'll be very happy to signpost. But I want the audience to know today that the pharmacist is a really good health professional to talk to about any contraindications. And if you have got sleep issues, you know, Dr. Stanley, when he comes down to speak to our women's groups in Taunton, you know, some of the women, they're all on their own, you know, everybody's in a different place with their cancer journey, but some of them have been giving, like, temazepam, and some of them, they feel quite dopey the next day, and they can't live life well so much the next day. So there are other medications, like, some of the anti-anxiety medications actually really are good for sleep. So not just good for anxiety, but they're also very good to get into a regular, good quality sleep pattern. So there's other medications that a good GP with good sound knowledge on quality of sleep would be able to navigate that with everybody in the group, if you were worried about that.
So So I do trust diazepam because I know it leaves the system after 4 hours. Mm. And so I kind of trust that. My second question was, I kind of get quite hungry about 9-ish, 10-ish. So if I had half a banana then,
yes,
instead of some crackers and cheese, is that good? Is that a good idea? As you said, yes, great.
Yeah,
and maybe a cup of hot milk or something. So
it's got tryptophan in it, and that would be a nice snack for you to have. And also it would keep your blood sugar stable overnight as well. So that's some of the literature that I've read has said that those foods are okay for nighttime.
Lovely. Thank you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Annie. It's David here from Exmouth.
Hello, David.
Very nice talk. I came in a bit late because I had a fire safety check going on from the fire brigade, so I missed but what I was ringing in to say, actually, Annie, was I was diagnosed with prostate cancer just before Christmas. I'm getting a lot better. The PSA readings are significantly, but what I was warned of is hot flushes. It's similar to the women with menopause, and I'm getting a lot of sleepless nights at the moment because I'm sweating so much. And I know what you women must go through because these hot flashes seem to come on more at night. Now, what the cancer nurse recommended was to go and have acupuncture, and I declined on it. I don't know what your views are on that. If you're in that area of knowledge, acupuncture for hot flushes.
Yeah. I think...
just nights, Annie.
Thank you, David. Thank you. That's a really good question for you to ask. And I attended a lecture actually recently with a lovely specialist GP. She's a menopause expert, Dr. Angela Wright, and it was through the Maggie Centre. She was running a session on just dealing with the menopause as a whole, which obviously you're going through similar symptoms with thermo disturbance and the hot flushes and the night sweats, which can be quite debilitating. But from a medical point of view, there, Angela Wright, she mentioned that because quality of life for you at the moment is actually really, 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 really important, and sleep for you, for all of us, is really, 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 really important. Now, acupuncture does help, and it's very in vogue at the moment in oncology. A lot of clients are using it for things like pain management, for nausea, it seems to be, for stress, for fatigue, all of that. But if you've had your disturbance and you're having these night sweats and flushes, there are other medications that your GP can advocate. So if you were to go and see the doctor with the specialist interest, perhaps in oncology, they might be able to advise you about some conventional medicine as well that would be able to help you to get a better night's sleep. And they're not sleeping tablets. Their medications.
She hasn't actually recommended anything really, the oncology nurse, only the acupuncture. But I must admit, my doctor recommended listening to Karen there, jog my memory, and a tripling. And I'm a bit adverse to that. I had them years ago, and you get hooked on them, I find. I didn't want to take them.
Yeah. Interestingly, Dr. Neil Stanley from Surrey University, when he came to our group, some of the ladies had stopped prescribing amitriptyline, I think because of the cost, and the temazepams were cheaper. But Dr. Stanley advocated that amitriptyline is actually very good for sleep, and that's the discussion that you could have with your GP. But there are other medications around for the night sweats. A drug called venlafaxine, which is very good for night sweats, but that was something that you'd need to speak to your doctor about, David. But you know what, David? If you're struggling with sleep, the nurse specialist in oncology will obviously be able to advise, but your medical team.
I'm not knocking them, but they are can be a lengthy process getting them to call you back. I'm not knocking them. They do a brilliant job, and they really helped me with this prostate. But it's getting a call back that sometimes can be a long time. But as I say, sorry, just to repeat myself, that's all she recommended was the acupuncture, in fact, and the doctor recommended anatropine. But I'm going to maybe have to pursue that a bit more because I am getting disturbed during the day. I'm not as, feel a bit weak. I haven't got a lot of go in me. I'm not totally blind. I'm severely sight impaired with a guide dog, but I'm not on top form, let's put it that way.
Okay, bless you.
Thanks.
You know what
Thanks.
I'm hearing?
Thank you.
I was just going to say, I work for breast cancer now, and we have our own secondary breast cancer specialists at work. We have a chat group, you know, that patients can phone in and spend an hour talking to them about any specific area they're worried about. But I was just thinking with Prostate Cancer UK, they may actually have a helpline where you can speak to one of the clinicians, but also for I'd go back to your GP and just tell them you're not sleeping, because we're not sleeping. It's really serious.
Yeah, I know. Probably was me feel weak, and I'm not on top form. Let's put it as I don't feel like doing very much, but I do it. I just push myself into doing it. But I know there's a change in my body. I know that, and it's with the sleep. That's all it is.
And sleep, we become, our cognitive ability in the day is quite badly affected, more than we know.
Yeah.
Okay. Annie, it's Graham again here. Can I just ask you to just give a little bit of an insight into the benefits of actually participating in their counselling, how that can help people?
Yeah, I think in counselling, in that sacred space, it actually helps you to have what I call a bit of a holistic approach, a bit like having an MOT with your car. So as therapists, we work with the whole person. So we look at the mind, the body, and the spirit. So for me, in my professional work, I use a model where I look at the person and see what their sleep is like, what their nutrition's like, what their emotions are like. And when we go through, you know, having a sight impediment, having cancer, having, you know, COVID, all of those things can destabilize us a little bit. And I think having a safe, sacred space to talk through how you're feeling, what your emotions are, your reactions to things. And when you work with a counsellor, they're not your friends, they're not your mother, they're not your partner, they're not your children. You can have really open, free conversations with somebody who would not judge you. Or it's a really safe place to have a little MOT and to look at how you're navigating your ship. The ship of life, I call it, my ship.
So one of the difficulties we have here is particularly getting men to engage with counselling. Is that a universal problem?
Yes, because if you go back to the cave woman and the caveman, the cave woman did an awful lot of the holding of the family unit while the partner was out doing his caveman bit. And historically, women tend to be the health gatekeepers in family units, and men are notoriously bad at putting their hands up and saying, yeah, I need a bit of emotional support. But I think we're beginning to change that now. But men looking after their emotional health and well-being is really important, and men tend to go later to the doctors when there's problems, whereas women will, you know, tend to be more proactive, whereas men will just be like the caveman. They'll just push on rather than maybe stop, taking a moment to stop and think actually about what do I need to attend to here? Is it my body? Is it my emotions? And sometimes with counselling, Graham, a lot of people think that just because they see a counsellor, they've got a mental health issue. Well, that couldn't be further from the truth, because counselling is just a really safe, grounding space for people to say it as it is without holding back and filtering. They can just let it out, and from that the healing will begin. But yes,
men are they tend to not come forward as much as women for therapy.
But I think this also works with people in business, and I'm including charity work as well. But, you know, you've got to look after yourself before you can help other people. And also, you know, I'm a strong advocate of mentoring people. Sometimes people are new in a position at work, and they don't want to be seen to be weak. And in fact, sometimes just saying, you know, how should I deal with this problem or something, and talking it through with a trusted colleague can be really useful. So, yeah, I'm really interested in what you've been saying today. This is fantastic. Do we have another question, please?
Harry, it's Jane. It's not a question. It's really just sharing. When you mentioned about, but thank you for your good talk, by the way. When you mentioned about the worries, I just wanted to share my daughter, who's autistic, and I was given a thing by another person who was working with her to call worry dolls, and you've probably come across them, where she picked them out and then put one and each worry before she went to bed. So it was a physical thing to do. So for us people who are blind, if we can't see to write, I don't know if that's a good... I know it's it was for a child with autism, but it can also be used for anyone. I was just like really amazed by this simple tool. It's this little tiny dolls that you picked up, you said your worry, and then you put it away. And it really helped her to understand how to, you know, get her sleep routine in place. It was, you know, I just wanted to share that. I don't know why, I just felt it's a good thing to share. But thank you anyway.
That's lovely, because you can also use imagery, Jane. In therapy, we talk about the glass being half empty or the glass being half full or the glass bubbling over. And visually in my therapy room, I sometimes ask my clients to put like pebbles into a glass, about, you know, they put all their worries in. Each like pebble symbolizes one of their worries. And then when they put all their worries into the glass, it kind of bubbles over a bit. So we look at things that we can take, or things that we can control and things that we can't control in the therapy room. But it's the same with the worry doll. You can almost visually, as you were talking, I was visualizing myself actually, putting the worries. But you can use, the power of the mind is phenomenal. So you could actually visualize, you know, use the platform that you feel comfortable with. So it could be putting pebbles in a glass or putting pebbles in a worry doll, or so that you can use your mind and your imagination as well for your worries.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'll just share. I have this, it's Karen. I have this thing where, you know, when you go to bed, you're all calm and everything, but then when you lay down to go to sleep, your mind starts racing and whizzing and everything. And I, worries, you know, worries. Then I get up and I actually remember what you said in the last talk. You know, I kind of think, okay, this is just fear, it's coming up now and I don't need to worry about it. But I sit down in a certain place in my lounge and I say, okay, dear Dow, let's have a therapy session. And I just speak as if speaking to the universe, and I kind of voice my fears out loud. I just, you know, I'm when I say Tao, you know, the Tao is the way that it hasn't got a personage, but I just say it, and it really, really, really does help. I calm, you know, something becomes calm in me, and usually have some hot milk at the same time, and then I go back to bed. And these are times when I'm not taking paracetamol, or I'm not taking my diazepam and codeine, you know, so that works for me as well. It's just a very gentle way.
Yeah, and listening to, I don't know if you have some audio books, but even before bed, taking a bath and maybe listening to an audio book or putting your worries somewhere or just doing some stretches. So with with looking after yourself at night, just, you know, our bedroom routine is really important, you know. You're even eating at the same time every day, eating breakfast, even, like, we have breakfast, which signals that we wake, you know, that we're going to wake up. But just looking after yourself is really, really important. And attending to what you need is really important.
I loved what you the way that you bring, you know, the chemicals and also the emotions into your talk, Tammy. And I started drinking kefir after I'd been to the hospital. It was something to do with, there was a worry, you know, a concern about something, my urine. And anyway, I had to go to see a specialist at the hospital. And it wasn't anything. She worked it out. But at the same time, she said, I'm telling every lady who comes to visit me to start having half a cup of kefir a day for their gut. And and I said, oh, I always take Yakult, you know, which are these kind of like little, they look like little old-fashioned milk bottles. You know, you get them in Morrison's. And she said, oh, no, they're just industrial. There's no good to them. Get natural kefir and also take D-mammose tablets. You can get them at any health food center. And she said, you'll find that you'll hardly ever have urine infection if you take this. It's so good for you, which I've been doing ever since she said that. She was a Chinese doctor, actually, Dr. Zhang. She was wonderful. So I just share that with everyone. And I wonder if you, because I know that kefir and the gut, my daughter was looking at a pot of yogurt because I'd said to her, oh, Jenny, you should start taking kefir, you know. And she looked at a pot of Yobali natural yogurt, bio yogurt, and the bottle of natural kefir that comes from Riverford Farm up the road. And she said, my gosh, Mum, you know, all the goodness in the kefir and the goodness in the yogurt, the kefir has so much more. So I wonder if you want to talk about that when you talk about our gut health.
And our happy hormone, serotonin, 90% is actually produced in the gut. And there's a lot of talk around probiotics and keeping the bacteria happy in our gut. Now, kefir is a little bit more expensive than yogurt, but some of the nutritionists advocate using like natural Greek yogurt, which has got some of the live cultures in it. So anything that's good for the gut is good for your brain because of the serotonin link with it. But you can buy probiotics in Holland and Barrett or Boots or whatever, but it can be quite expensive. But also there is for probiotic for the stomach, there's a product called kimchi, which is like, I'm sure you've all heard of sauerkraut. So a spoonful of sauerkraut every day is really good for us. But now, I'm not a doctor, so I have to be mindful of giving advice. But with the nutritionist, they do recommend something to have a healthy gut every day. So that could be kefir, it could be natural Greek yogurt, $2 of it. It could be some kimchi or sauerkraut. Everybody's taste is going to be different and everybody's budget is going to be different. So just being mindful of what works for you. So looking after our gut health is very much in the now, actually, in the world of wellbeing.
Annie, I think we're coming to the end of the call now. So on behalf of everybody, I would just like to say thank you so much for everything you've had to say today. We've got a couple of pages in the newsletter that we're going to give over to your Good Sleep Guide.
Great.
So we'll put that in there for you. I think the other thing for me just to stress is that as a charity, we do not give any medical advice. So if you are deciding to make any major changes to your diet or look at things like medication, we've talked about amitriptyline and all those sorts of things, please do speak to a healthcare professional.
Always.
I'd just like to say that our next speaker event is on Tuesday, the 13th of June, and we've got Ian Johnson joining us from the Devon and Somerset Fire and Rescue Service. David's just had his home safety check. I hope that went well for you, David.
Went very well, Graham. It's well worth doing, I tell you, because things you forget, he reinforces on you. Yeah, it was a very good. He was here for about just over half an hour. He fitted two brand new carbon monoxide detectors, a heat alarm, and also the normal fire safety things you put on the ceiling. Yeah, the smoke alarms.
Smoke alarms.
Yeah.
It's well worth having done.
Yes.
Well with it. And it is all free as well.
David, did he talk about escape routes and all that sort of thing as well?
He did indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
And he did say, so I know we're running out of time here.
That's all right.
If your carbon monoxide detector goes off or your heat alarm, you must stop, ring 999 and wait for help. Don't try and get involved with it, you know. Your smoke alarm, that's a bit of a different story, but the heat and carbon monoxide, they're the two important ones. You must stop, don't touch anything, 999, and wait for them to turn up. Yeah, it's all of you in the group, it's well worth having, I tell you. Simple things that you forget about. Yeah.
Thank you very much,
yes,
David.
Thank you, David.
So the other thing we're going to look at is how the fire service can help with some of those issues around the physicality of where you live, mobility around the home, and also the mental health dangers of hoarding. So that will be an interesting little talk. And then also we've got a Living Well with Sight Loss event on the 29th of June, which will be at the Anchorage Centre in Tavistock. And those of you who live in that area will be receiving an invite to that. And in August, we've got one in Tiverton. So again, in due course, you will hear about that. Tess, anything you want to add?
No, the chit-chat call takes place tomorrow, and I look forward to speaking to you all then. But other than that, Annie, can I say from my point of view, I found it very, very interesting today, and I've learnt quite a few things that I wouldn't have known had I not have joined the call. So thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody.
Yes, thank
bye-bye.
You, Annie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.